My name is Michael Gaia, publisher of The Lead Lag Report. Joining me for the hour is Jonathan Matthews. Jonathan, I know we connected kind of briefly on that other space that we were both on, but introduce up to the audience and to me more formally, who are you, what's your background, what have you done throughout your career, and what are you doing currently?
Yeah, thank you, Michael. First of all, thank you very much for having me on the show. I'm honored to be here. Just briefly, I was a partner at Brevan Howard. I was a portfolio manager for 12 years there, trading macro. And prior to that, I was a trader at Citigroup for about 11 years, where I was trading mainly equity derivatives and FX. Since I left Brevan Howard, I've been managing my own capital. I write an institutional level research piece called Super Macro. And that goes out to pretty much someone in every one of the investment banks here in the City of London and a lot of the large hedge funds. And about 6 months ago, I decided to make it available to retail subscribers. So the subscriptions are building up. And it basically, Super Macro really explains what's going on with the economic data. And I give my opinion of what the likely impact is on markets. And I also talk about my own trades. I'm still managing my own capital, and I put the details in the weekend note for what I'm doing and why. So that, in a nutshell, is what I've been up to.
So I'm going to ask an odd question, but I think an important one, which is, what does trading macro actually mean? And where I'm going with that is, look, we all talk macro, right? Everyone loves to talk about macro on FinEx. And I would go back to this point that macro, you know, tells you the likely outcome, but not necessarily how you get there. And trading is about the path, right? So how do you think about trading macro, what that actually means in practice?
Well, that's a great question. I've got to tell you, and I did this interview on Alpha Minds a while ago about the difficulty in transitioning from being a market maker in an investment bank to being a portfolio manager at a hedge fund. Very difficult, actually, because at a hedge fund, as soon as you do a trade, the mark-to-market is going to be against you. So you've got to be very sure of what you're doing and why you're doing it. You've got to be able to analyze the economic data, the fundamentals of the trade, implied volatility, if you're doing volatility, relative value, or all those kind of factors, and think about why it is that the market has mispriced whatever it is that you think should be a different price to where it currently is. So I've found that in all honesty, there's probably only one or two really good trades per year. So for a lot of the time, you're analyzing the data, you think you find some opportunities, putting on trades in fairly small size, waiting for that really great opportunity. And I've got to say that since I left Brevan Howard and I've started doing my own research and my own analysis, I found that whole process of clarifying my thoughts, analyzing the data, doing my own research, taking research from a variety of other sources and thinking about whether they've got the correct idea of what's going on, putting all that together, putting my own charts together where I compare economic variables, see if there's a correlation, doing all that stuff myself, I found has improved my trading a great deal. It's really crystallized my thoughts, made things very clear. And I've also found that there are certain analysts are just stuck in a particular way of thinking. Either it's confirmation bias, they have a particular idea that the economy is, for example, going into a recession, and they look at every new piece of data, they'll try to find some element of it that supports their view, regardless of the fact that they've been wrong about a recession coming for the last 2 years. And so I've learned that really, you've got to do your own research. You've got to think, work things out for yourself. And I do actually read, I'm not going to say which research outfit it is, but I have a subscription to a number of different economic consultants. One in particular has been firmly in the economic slowdown camp and has been wrong. But their research is very good, and I like to understand their rationale for thinking that. I disagree with it, and I've got my own views about where the US economy is going, but I like to hear the contrary argument as well, just to sort of just to make sure that I'm really thinking along the right lines.
I'm glad you made that point about there's really only one or two good trades in a year, because I do find a lot of people seem to think that the way this game is played is by hitting the singles and the doubles. But in reality, you know, the game is won from the home runs, right? From the those junctures where, you know, you really kill it from a magnitude perspective. The thing is, you and I both know the timing of that is always the question mark, right? You might have a thesis. I mean, gold is a good example of what of that right now. A lot of people have been bullish on gold for a while, and now suddenly it's working. You can argue that they were wrong and early, or you can argue that they were just in time, depending upon how long your own view of time is. Talk about some of just from your own trading portfolio, what some of those really big outsized trades have been for you historically. Let's go through some war stories.
Yeah. Well, okay. Tell you a great war story going back to when I was at Brevan Howard before the financial crisis. And I had really done a lot of volatility relative value using variance swaps, all kinds of complex structures in equity indices. I had all these relative value trades on, and I had some idea of the macro. I didn't focus as strongly on the macro at that time. And then in 2007, I don't know if you remember, I think it was around about August, there was some kind of funding crisis. You know, the LIBOR spreads blew out, the TID spread blew out. And I'd been, for a long time, I'd been reading about the housing market. We knew the housing market was going to collapse. And at the time, I thought, I felt so sick that I wasn't just outright long volatility. I thought that was going to be the end of the world. When that crisis first started to erupt, it was in 07, but I thought this was the beginning of the end for the markets. And as it happens, that crisis blew over and the S&P rallied in towards the end of 2007. And it was just the most fantastic opportunity to really get long of volatility. In my case, variance swaps, which are a slightly complex way of capturing collapse in the market, but they have such a strongly convex payoff. If you get it right, you really clean up. Now, when we went into 2008, those variance swaps really started to pay off. But just to put things in perspective, at the start of 2008, the markets were declining, volatility was picking up, implied volatility on these variance swaps went from 20 to 30, then it came back down to 20, then it went back up to 30. The market had a rally. I remember this in April of that year. And, you know, I started giving back a hell of a lot of money. And then by the summer of 2008, volatility picked up again. The market was tumbling. This was before Lehman disappeared. Things were going, you know, I'd made a shitload of money and I really just cashed the whole lot in. I thought this is as good as it gets. It's going to be a great year. I don't have to do anything for the rest of the year and I'm going to get paid a load of money. It's great. Cashed the whole lot in. And of course, then Lehman blew up and I missed out on probably making three times as much. It's not the end of the world, but just to your point, Michael, timing is really difficult. Now, I could have put that, I could have been a long variance swaps the prior year, and I would have just bled money. I could have held on to those variance swaps for a little bit longer and made three times as much. But, you know, I think you've got to have an idea in your mind of what you're trying to achieve with any trade that you put on. And it's very important not to get greedy. Just don't get greedy. I mean, in my case, that was good enough. And then obviously, as we rolled into 2009, by I think March of 2009, if you had come to the right conclusion that the world wasn't going to end, honestly, you could have just picked any sort of assets, whether it was credit, whether it was complex things like forwards on the Nikkei, which were, when you looked at them, they were pricing negative dividend yields on the Nikkei. That everything was so out of line, you could just take your pick with whatever you wanted to buy. You're going to make a lot of money in 2009. So that's not really a war story. That's just, you know, how things worked while I was at Brevan Howard. Those were great couple of years. For me, in more recent times, at the start of 2022, I was on vacation in the States, into Las Vegas and Palm Springs and Los Angeles. And obviously reading the macro and the pandemic was sort of coming to an end. The US was partially opening things up. And the 10-year treasury yield, I think at the time, was 1.2%. And it seemed very clear to me at that time that as soon as the US really opened up properly, there was going to be an almighty boom. These rates were just completely the wrong price. And that was the great trade for 2022, just being short treasuries, really.
Convexity is always the thing you want to go after, obviously. Convexity tends to happen with extraordinary volatility, right? Just given the way that tail event seemingly come out of nowhere and the payout associated with that. I am curious in terms of the environment that we're in now, where is their convexity potential? Where is that there, this fat pitch, this asymmetric payoff from what you're looking at?
Well, the funny thing is often you don't know where these really far right-hand tails or far left-hand tails, whatever you want to think about them, are hidden until after the event. In 2008, when the world blew up and I thought I had unwound all my variance swaps, anybody that really has a deep understanding of variance swaps and the nature of convexity within them, when you actually unwind the trade, if it's at a different implied volatility to where you put the trade on, there is a tiny residual amount. The two trades have different convexities. Now, ordinarily, this doesn't make any difference. When you're dealing with vols 20 or vols 30, it doesn't make a difference. But when vol goes to 80, as it did, that tiny little residual bit of convexity all of a sudden becomes worth a whole lot more, a whole lot more. The same thing with some of the variance swaps were capped. If you buy a variance, typically the cap was at 2.5 times strike. So if you paid 20 for a variance swap, it would have been capped at 50. And then if you unwound it at 30, it's going to be capped at 75. So you think you're flat, but you've still got a little residual kind of call spread on volatility between 50 and 75. Now, this kind of stuff, we never thought would come alive ever. But of course, at the end of 2008, it did come alive and it did bite a lot of people in the arse. So, this very difficult to see in advance where this convexity might be hiding. For me, as things stand right now, and I've written about this in my daily note, I look at the major indices, the implied volatility on, for example, the S&P is barely in double digits at the money implied vol. Same with the Euro stocks. It's rarely this low. And especially, the short dated options coming into this week where you've got the JOLTS data, you've got payrolls, you've got European CPI reports, you've got a whole number of significant macro events that could just shake things up a bit. Certainly change the profile of interest rates and what's priced into the rates market. And I think with implied volatilities this low, it's worth just having a strangle or a straddle or something and either hedging it to capture the volatility or just, buying some out the money options and hoping for the best.
Yeah, I've been highlighting in the last several weeks what I think could be the start of a currency crisis between really primarily from Japan. I think they started the process, right, with their hiking rates minimally and the yen still depreciating. And now they're telegraphing, right, that they're going to intervene. And also now China, right, telling state-sponsored banks to intervene with the yuan. And the dollar's been strong and looks like it wants to, break out here. What are your thoughts on currency volatility maybe spilling over? Because I think that's where it gets to be interesting and potentially quite messy.
I agree with you.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Hello, listeners. Michael Guyatt here from Lead Lag Live. Are you ready to take a deep dive into market trends, risk management, and investment strategies? Then you need the Lead Lag Report. Our in-depth analysis helps you understand the financial markets like never before. And guess what? We're giving you a chance to experience it at a discounted rate. Visit theleadlag.report/leadlaglive and get an exclusive 30% off on your subscription. Don't miss out. Level up your investment game with the Lead Lag Report. And now, back to our discussion.
I said this a couple of weeks ago in a podcast. I'm surprised the dollar has held up as well as it has. While you have, just after that Fed meeting, when I thought they'd lost the plot, really, they're still signaling three, they were signaling three rate cuts, but they'd revised up their inflation forecast and the growth forecast for this year. And yet they hadn't, you know, changed the median expectation of where rates were going. And the data has since been picking up. Just for example, let's take the PCE inflation rate, core PCE inflation. Before Christmas, Powell was highlighting how core PCE, the 6 months rate on an annualized basis, was 1.9%. Great. You know, there they are on the way to the 2% target. They made a big deal out of that. Now, in this latest PCE inflation report, we see that the annualized rate of 6 months PCE inflation is now 2.9%. It's gone from 1.9 to 2.9. The Fed isn't talking about that anymore. So I think there is a danger. There is a danger that the Fed, you know, they like to stick with their forward guidance. They've spoken about rate cuts for a long time now, you know, since November, that was the peak in rates and everybody started pricing in rate cuts. As a result, financial conditions eased, the market took off, household wealth went through the roof, everything was great. They, I think, now believe they have to follow through with the rate cuts. And I'm surprised. To me, it seems there's a risk of currency debasement here. And I said a couple of weeks ago, I'm surprised gold hasn't done better. Now, I didn't have the trade on at the time. I just couldn't understand why, with all this dovishness in the face of reasonably strong economic data, I was surprised that gold wasn't attracting more money as an inflation hedge. Obviously, it's, you know, it's had a good run in the last week. But when it comes to currency volatility, usually it's driven by widening rate differentials. And I think the market is pricing a similar sort of pace of easing from the major central banks, apart from Japan. Just getting back to Japan, Japan's going in the opposite direction. And I think Japan, it's difficult. I mean, my God, anyone that trades FX would have had a go at, in the past, at going long dollar yen one way or another with options, longer dated options, expecting the yen to just have a nasty run at some point. And it hasn't happened. But now I think maybe things will start to pick up. Implied volatility is still very low in all currencies. I mean, realized volatility has been incredibly low. So I think any opportunity that you see in FX, you know, you should use the options market to express it with, like, you know, 1 month options or however you want to do it. It's a cheap way of putting on a trade, cheap and low risk way of doing it. So I am hopeful, especially for the FX traders out there that have had a really rough time the last couple of years with nothing going on. I'm hopeful that now we will see some sort of differentiation in central bank policies. Especially if you look at the European data, the European inflation prints have come below expectations in Germany, France, Italy, and Spain, the big four European countries. We've got the Eurozone aggregate inflation print tomorrow. And there is just a possibility that the ECB actually cuts ahead of the Fed, which would be quite something. So maybe we will start to see a pickup in FX volatility.
The argument is that the Fed wants to cut rates because of the election. I'm not a believer in that. I know that's a line that you hear constantly. It seems to me more likely that maybe the Fed's still telegraphing cuts because they're expecting some kind of a risk. And I keep going back to where I still think it's, you know, no different than the way the Pentagon has plans to invade every single country, right? Including, you know, England, right? And I mean, literally, there are plans for that because that's just what Pentagon does. The Fed must have similar type of scenario analysis and plans on the back end. It's like, all right, well, if Japan were to raise rate by X amount and it has this kind of impact on currencies, then it might impact equities. So we want to cut rates if that happens, right? I'm sure there's scenario analysis like that. So how much of the rate cut narrative could simply be because the simplest answer is the right one, which is that the Fed sees something or knows that there is a scenario that would require them to do so anyway?
I'm not a great believer in these sort of specific conspiracy theories. You know, I do think, though, that the Fed, prior to Christmas, they were talking about
an excessive tightening of financial conditions. And it's true at the time that, you know, treasury yields had risen a long way. Equities had a rough year. Credit was a lot wider than it currently is. And then Waller first gave that speech where I think it was the end of November. And then we had the Fed meeting at the beginning of December where they highlighted the fact that financial conditions had tightened. They were doing the Fed's work for it. And so the Fed should cut just to sort of offset that tightening of financial conditions. And then Waller made the point that as inflation starts declining, if they don't cut the Fed funds rate, then the real Fed funds rate is going to be increasing. And I think they gave all that forward guidance. And now, to some extent, they feel like they need to follow through. I'm not sure the timing of the election should be a major factor, but there is this issue that if they don't cut in June, the next summary of economic projections is going to be in September, just a month before the election. It's going to look a little bit fishy if the Fed suddenly cuts just before the election. It's going to look like that's really not going to look ideal. So to some extent, maybe because of the election calendar, they feel like, okay, well, we better get the first cut done in June, and then we can do another one in September. It'll be part of a sequence. And to be honest with you, a 25 basis point cut or two of them in sequence really isn't going to make much difference to the economic outcomes. I think to some extent, the Fed has an exaggerated opinion of the impact of monetary policy these days. You know, we had a decade after the financial crisis when rates were zero and the yield curve was super flat. Households termed out their funding. So did businesses. And now the rate hikes that we've had, the monetary policy tightening has had far less impact than might have been expected. And we can see that in the economic performance. I mean, the Fed hiked rates. They did the first 425 basis points of hikes in this cycle in 2022. And they talk about the long and variable lags between, you know, their actions and the impact on the economy. But, you know, they did most of the hiking in 2022. They did another 100 basis points in 23. And growth in the second half, in the last two quarters of 2023, was at an average annualized rate north of 4%. So quite clearly that those rate hikes didn't have the kind of impact that might have been expected. And, you know, if you look at the household sector, household wealth has gone up something like 40 trillion since the pandemic. I mean, it's just a ridiculous number. And sometimes you think, okay, so what does that mean? Well, what it means is that households, sure, the savings rate has gone down, but households don't need to save. Why do they need to save at the same rate they used to be? They're much richer than they ever used to be. And that increase in wealth, the percentage increase in wealth, is quite evenly spread across the income distribution. You know, those at the lower end of the income distribution have had the same sort of 30% increase in their net worth, same as those at in the top 1%. So I, the bottom line is that the Fed policy tightening hasn't had, in fact, it's done nothing to household wealth. That's gone through the roof. And then you look at the corporate sector and you have the corporate sector deleveraged itself after the financial crisis. And by the corporate sector, I'm talking about the non-financial corporate sector. Okay, so we're excluding the banks. Deleveraged itself after the financial crisis. And now you've got companies like Meta, Apple, with I think Apple, Alphabet, I think who are net, who earn income on their cash piles. And so if you look at the net interest paid by the corporate sector as a percentage of profits, it's the lowest it's been in decades. So the bottom line is these rate hikes haven't impacted the economy anywhere near as much as might have been expected. So we're at a point now where I think the only reason the Fed really is going to cut is because They believe they have to follow through with their forward guidance, and the electoral calendar would make it easy if they don't go in June and then September. They will get attacked by both sides of the political spectrum.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Foodies unite with How You Dish. It's social media with a secret sauce. Food, the world's first network for food enthusiasts. How You Dish connects foodies across the world. Share kitchen tips and recipe hacks. Discover hidden gem food joints and street food. Find foodies like you. Connect, chat, and organize meetups. How You Dish makes it simple to connect through food anywhere in the world. So, how do you dish? Download How You Dish on the Apple App Store now.
Just reset the room, everybody. Please make sure you follow Jonathan Matthews here on X. If any of you want to come up and ask questions, click that bottom left mic request button. And as always, this will be in podcast under Lead Lag Live on all of your three platforms, Apple, YouTube, and Spotify. I agree with you, by the way, on that point. I've floated the idea that if you were to have a currency crisis, and if it does get sparked by Japan, that gives them the scapegoat, because it's a lot easier to say that they lower rates closer to the election if there's an entity outside the U.S. that's causing them to, right? It becomes sort of an excuse for them, but, you know, unclear how that plays out. Do you think that we're at a point in the cycle now where even if the Fed were to actually hike rates, the Fed can't do it alone? It needs something exogenous as a shock to really get inflation to that 2% level?
Well, I do think so now. I think from the Fed's point of view, where we are now, where growth has been really solid for the last few years, got inflation, they've done the easy part of getting inflation back down again. To get it all the way down to 2%, they're going to have to really do something quite nasty to the economy. And I say this because when you break down the components of inflation, you look at the dynamics of what's going on there. We had what I would call the transit. They were kind of right about transitory. If your timescale is 2 years for transitory, and that, the supply chain snags and the energy crisis and all that has now played out. So if we look at durable goods prices, you had prices for used cars that were up more than 40% year over year, and then they went into free fall. And so, the declines in used car prices are coming to an end now. So durable goods prices were a drag on inflation. Energy was a drag on inflation. Those two components are now reversing. So it's quite clear that base effects in energy mean that energy is going to be making a positive contribution to inflation. Goods prices, I think, will go from making a negative contribution to making zero or maybe a small positive. Food disinflation is still ongoing, but then you come to services inflation, and that really hasn't declined much at all. While you've got wage growth, if we use something like the Lancet Fed wage growth tracker, it's still growing at about 5%. Very hard to get services inflation much below 4% where it is now, I think. So I think we're going to be left with a core inflation that is dominated by services. Well, we already are. And I think that's going to be an ongoing problem. So for the Fed, they've got a choice. If they really want to get inflation down to 2%, they could hike rates, they could crush the economy, they could send unemployment up another 2%, 2 percentage points, should we say, tip the economy into a recession, and sure enough, we get inflation back down to target. Or they could say, we'll keep rates where they are, maybe do a couple of little tweaks, and we can see that disinflation process is still ongoing. It may be beginning to peter out. Maybe inflation settles down at something like 3%, while we've got full employment and while economic growth is north of 2% still. Maybe that's not such a bad outcome as far as they're concerned. Maybe it's not such a bad outcome. I don't think they would ever admit that they've changed the inflation target. They will still say, okay, well, we're still expecting inflation to decline towards 2%. They'll give all kinds of reasons. I think they may well be happy with an inflation rate that's 3% and economic growth staying intact and unemployment staying extremely low. That's not such a bad outcome. It's also a good outcome for the Treasury. If you look at countries with high debt to GDP ratios, like, for example, the UK after the Second World War, where our debt to GDP was something like 200-something%. And the way you get it down is a combination of financial repression. So you find a way of convincing people to buy your long-dated paper, and you have a period of high nominal GDP growth, a combination of reasonably strong growth and high inflation. And that is the best way to get your debt to GDP back down again. And perhaps that is what the US is going to do. Debt to GDP in the US, I think it peaked at over 130% just after the pandemic, and it's come down to 120% or so as a result of very strong nominal GDP growth over these last few years. The trick is getting investors, convincing investors to still buy your long-dated paper while it's still got a relatively low yield. So that, I think, is, you know, the US is managing that process quite well so far. Absolutely. I mean, the point you made is a very valid one, but I think from looking at the experience with the Fed's true reaction function, when there is a market crisis, they will find an excuse to cut rates. Let's put it this way. If household wealth takes a really big hit as a result of an exogenous event somewhere, that will bring down consumer spending. I think if, for example, if the equity market really gets crushed, the CEOs will start firing people to improve the bottom line. That's just the way the world works. And so I think from the Fed's point of view, they'll be very reactive to an event like that, regardless of the outlook for inflation. They'll be able to say, well, you know, we're looking at these forward indicators of employment and economic growth, and it's quite clear to us that things are looking ugly. And don't forget this, you know, the Fed a while ago said they're going to be data dependent, not forecast dependent. And yet, you know, the data recently have picked up. Inflation, you know, they had two consecutive upside surprises to inflation. Employment growth was much stronger than they were expecting. And yet they're still forecasting. I think Powell said, you know, labor market indicators point to some softening and all that kind of nonsense. So they're relying on the forecast to justify the start of a rate cutting cycle. The Fed will always be able to find some excuse to cut rates if there was a collapse in asset prices. Without a doubt, in my mind, they would pull the trigger on rate cuts. And it's interesting, one of the other points you made about the labor market and supply of labor kind of drying up, partly due to demographics, I would have thought another factor in that is that people's 401ks have just gone through the roof. So a lot of people that may be approaching retirement can now think, well, what the hell, cash the whole lot in and I'll tell the boss what to do with his job. I mean, so in a sense, this rapid increase in household wealth, is it in a way exacerbating the labor shortage and lowering the participation rate? But that's a slightly different issue. Just to your point, I do think, yeah, without a doubt, the Fed will cut if there is some kind of blow up.
Yeah, I guess it's a question of the when, right? It's like, you know, do they respond immediately or is it with a delay, to Bondoc's point, just to create some disinflationary pressure, you know, to take hold? And we'll see. I mean, these are all different scenarios. Let's go to her question. Go ahead.
I do think there is a case for bullishness for a little while longer. And there are major differences with 2008. Primarily, it's the leverage. I mean, household in 2008 were using their houses as ATMs. I mean, yeah, they were just getting HELOCs and taking the money and, you know, buying a new jet ski or a motorcycle or whatever they did with it. So the more, you know, there were so many households that had remortgaged, and they had a mortgage that was worth roughly the same value as the house. And as soon as the housing market took a minor tumble, obviously, the whole house of cards collapsed, and that transmitted throughout. what was at the time a 10 trillion mortgage market, which was itself highly leveraged with these, with this tranching and the subprime and all the rest of it. It was highly leveraged. It only took a small decline in the value of housing to really cause catastrophic losses for the banking industry that were multiplied up by the withdrawal of credit in that space. I think there was something like, I can't remember the figures, it was something absolutely horrific if you look at the, if you looked at the global losses to the banking industry. Well, now you compare it to where we are now. House prices in the US have roughly doubled over the last 10 years. And throughout that period, people have been locking in lower and lower mortgage rates. So where we are now, the average outstanding rate, the average rate on all the outstanding mortgages is something like 3.7%. So for households, you know, the new mortgage rate is 7%. They're not going to sell. They're not going to give up their existing mortgage. They're not going to take home equity lines of credit. They're not doing anything like that. For many of these households, they've now got a mortgage which is worth, which is, you know, roughly half the value of the house. A huge amount of housing equity stored up. So the household is far less vulnerable than it was in 2008. And for corporates as well, when you look at the leverage, whichever way you look at it, it's tricky getting the aggregate data out of either Bloomberg or the Fed. The Fed thing is much easier. And you can tease some non-financial aggregate data out of that. The corporate sector is far less leveraged than it was. And primarily, we termed out funding rates. Sure, you've got some smaller companies and some highly leveraged companies that maybe just should go. You know, for the last 10 years, I've heard about how zombie companies were being kept alive by low rates. And we're seeing a misallocation of capital, keeping these companies alive. And it was bad for productivity and all the rest of it. Well, now we're going to have a bit of a clear out of those zombie companies that can't survive with a more normal level of rates. But I really don't see that the financial markets are on the brink of a catastrophic event like 2008. And you might think, well, how can you tell when something like that is about to happen? You really could. In 2005 and 2006, it was clear that the market was unsustainable, really clear. But obviously, if you did something about it back then in 2006, you were too early and you were getting screwed on your marks. Eventually, it did all come crashing down. It took longer than any of us expected, but it did in the end. But where we are now, I don't see those similarities. I don't see the vulnerabilities.
I will say, no disagree with anything you said. The leverage component is intriguing to me because I think you can make an argument that, and this is more about market structure, there is more leverage just from the proliferation of options trading than we've ever seen in markets before. And you don't have to have a crisis like 2008 that forces a household deleveraging, but you can certainly have a financial deleveraging event, I think. Right, just from that perspective. That's more of a market structure issue than anything else.
Yeah, I wonder about this option. I suspect that, this increased options trading, especially the same day options that become very popular. This is generally, I imagine, just retail punters taking a view and the market makers that hedge these reasonably competent. It's interesting because we haven't had a true test. We haven't had a significant move in the S&P for months. It will be interesting to see how the market copes with something that causes a big daily move, like, 3% in a day. What happens? Can they hedge themselves success? But I don't think, I don't think households have kind of leveraged themselves up with exposure to the stock market, the regulations have changed for how much margin exposure you can have now as a household and all this kind of stuff. So I'm not sure there is that inherent risk in the market to me, it doesn't seem that vulnerable. I think the bigger risk from my perspective is the rates market and something that might cause the long end of the rates market to become unanchored. And I mean, unanchored in a bad way where I don't know what will do it, But right now, investors are very happy to stick their money into a 10-year note because they're pretty confident that the Fed is going to cut rates. And so their expectations are anchored by the 10 years following the GFC. And they say, well, okay, you know, if the Fed's going to cut rates, probably going to go all the way back down to, you know, 2% or lower. We've got to lock in a yield north of 4% while we still can. That's what's keeping the long end of the fixed income market stable at the moment. If something changes and investors' expectations do become unanchored, whether it's, you know, via a pickup in inflation or delay to the cutting cycle, whatever it is, or resurgent economic growth, I don't know. That's when I think, you know, the whole market will become vulnerable. That's the big risk in my mind. Yeah, I think that is a very strong risk from my perspective. And I think that's why precious metals have had a good run lately. I think I think at the start of this year, when the market was pricing in 6 cuts from the Fed this year, I thought that was just absolutely insane. Now the market is pricing slightly less than 3 as of today, I believe. But I do think there is a strong risk that the Fed, like I said, goes ahead, does the cut in June and then again in September because they feel compelled to follow through with the forward guidance. And we do get a melt up, you know, economic growth stays robust. Corporate earnings are forecast to rise quite strongly this year and next year. And perhaps they will. And, you know, the market carries on. And then we get to some kind of bubble. And maybe it's the long end of the curve that sells off, you know, rates go a lot higher. Maybe that's what bursts the bubble, or maybe it's something else that I haven't even thought of. But that is a risk in my mind, that this, you know, rise in asset values just continues. I mean, who would have thought? Let's face it, probably the most interest rate sector of the economy, the housing market. You know, the Fed's jacked up rates 525 basis points, and yet house prices are going to new records now. So I think there is a risk of a bubble. Equities at a record highs, gold at a record high. So obviously it's off its highs, you know, currently, but you know, all this stuff kind of smells to me like a bubble being blown. And there are some vulnerabilities. Now, the interesting thing is when it comes to the election, and I do remember 2016 election because I was working all night at the time at a hedge fund. We were trading through the night. And that was crazy. Trump was an outlier at the time. He was, you know, he was really a long shot and he succeeded. I believe the two candidates are roughly 50-50 now in the bookies. So whichever outcome it is, it's not going to be a huge surprise. It can't be. I mean, you know, half the people already expect it to be either one or the other. And it doesn't seem to me like there's much fiscal consolidation going to take place. So I'm not really sure that the election of Trump this time around or Biden again would be a massive shock to the market. But that said, I think the Fed would want to avoid being accused of political meddling and will go ahead and follow through with its rate guidance.
Jonathan, for those who want to track more of your thoughts, more of your work, where would you point it to?
Oh, well, thank you. Yes, you can either look at super-macro.com, www.super-macro.com, or find me on Twitter at super_macro. So I think the best place is super-macro.com. Just go on the website. You can sign up for a 30-day free trial. And if you like the note, you can stick with it. Otherwise, just cancel it. It won't cost you anything.
All right. Please make sure you give Jonathan a follow. Great conversation. Hopefully all of you enjoyed it. Appreciate you, Jonathan. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me on the show. And thank you for all the intelligent questions. Really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Cheers, everybody.
The content in this program is for informational purposes only. You should not construe any information or other material as investment, financial, tax, or other advice. The views expressed by the participants are solely their own. A participant may have taken or recommended any investment position discussed, but may close such position or alter its recommendation at any time without notice. Nothing contained in this program constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, endorsement, or offer to buy or sell any securities or other financial instruments in any jurisdiction. Please consult your own investment or financial advisor for advice related to all investment decisions. Don't forget to follow at LeadLag Report on X, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and check out the LeadLag Report at www.leadlagreport.com. Use promo code PODCAST30 for 2 weeks free and 30% off to get access to award-winning research and anticipate stock market crashes, corrections, and bear markets.